The University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and major public research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries at UWM today. Here's the host of UWM Today, Tom Lujak, Vice Chancellor for University Relations and Communications.
Some newly released budget figures show that for the first time, Wisconsin is spending more for its prison and correctional system than it is for the University of Wisconsin system. The reason? A huge increase in the number of people incarcerated in state prisons. Having so many people in prison means that each year, large numbers of inmates are also released when their sentences are complete. On this edition of UWM Today, we're going to talk about what happens when those prisoners re-enter our society. Joining us from UWM are Tom LaBelle, Associate Professor of Criminal Justice, and Stan Stoykovich, the Dean of the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare. Welcome to both of you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Tom, let's start with you. How many people are we talking about when we consider both the numbers of folks who are in prison and those who are coming back into society?
Well, if we look across the United States, there's about 1.6 million people incarcerated in state and federal prisons today. If you add the jail population on any given day, the total would go to about 2.3 million people.
That's a lot of people. In fact, isn't it one of the highest numbers in terms of percentage of population of all countries in the world, right?
If you look across the world, the most recent figures show that the United States has approximately 5% of the world population, but we have about 25% of the incarceration population.
Well, there are a lot of reasons for that, and I think we're going to circle back and talk about some of those reasons and the size of the budgets involved. But we want to first hone in on the topic that I mentioned at the beginning, which is out of those millions of people who are in prison or jail, a goodly number of them come back into society each year. How big of a size population are we talking about?
Sure. Each year in the United States, approximately 700,000 people return from prisons each year. And if you think about this idea of people going to prison and returning, approximately 95% or more of all the people that get sent to prison are going to return from prison. And a really popular book in this area that got reentry really on the map by Jeremy Travis was essentially called, But They All Come Back. And I think that's one thing that people forget is that almost everyone that goes to prison is going to be returning to the community.
And so the whole notion of these really tough, long sentences putting people away for life, not necessarily true, Stan.
No. In fact, most offenses are just not that serious and don't warrant that kind of incarceration. We did have, back in the 1990s, a movement across the country called Three Strikes and You're Out. And Wisconsin was very fortunate in being prudent in that regard and not having such a restrictive and, I should say, a liberal application of the Three Strikes law. But we saw so many people go to prison. And at the end of the day, since they do, most of them come back, you have to ask two questions. One, while they were in prison, what did they get or receive that would hopefully either correct behavior or alter perceptions or allow them to lead a law-abiding lifestyle upon release? And B, what do we have in the state or across the states to receive them? When you have 600,000, 700,000 people coming home every year, the question then becomes a redirection of resources and what's appropriate redirection out of prisons, let's say, to reentry. And this is where the huge issue lies across this country. Not only in Wisconsin, do we have the resources as well as the wherewithal, the technology, the knowledge to make transition appropriate? I got to tell you, a lot of these gentlemen, and mostly men, 94% are men, coming back, are angry. They're angry because they didn't get much inside of an institution. What are we now prepared to do? We're now going to have to pay for decisions we made 10, 20, 30 years ago, particularly for people who did protracted longer sentences under mandatory sentencing or under a three strikes provision. So there are a lot of issues here that we have to confront.
Tom, you've done a lot of study. In fact, you've done a great deal of writing and research looking at the state of mind of these prisoners and the society that they're coming back to. What did you see or discover in your work?
Sure. I guess there's lots of issues. When you look at what leads to success or failure you know, after people get released from prison, a lot of them are, you know, basically almost, you know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs types of issues, right? That people are going to survive. They need, you know, adequate housing. People are struggling to obtain a job, you know, maintain that job that has a livable wage. Substance use is a real big issue for probably at least 70 to 80% of the population that's in prison and returning from prison. Some of the main, you know, issues when, you know, that lead, seem to lead to success when people get out, some of them are around, you know, changes in mindsets. You know, it takes a tremendous amount of self-belief for these individuals to, you know, turn their lives around. They also need support from others. So when you think about this, you know, idea of becoming successful, it's not just the individual turning from prison. It's also that other people have to allow that person to be successful, which is a big issue around the stigma, you know, of incarceration, you know, in and of itself. So if you have people that believe in that individual, willing to give them second chances, that can have a big impact in someone's life as well.
So, well, Stan mentioned the three strikes and you're out movement that existed not that long ago in terms of how a lot of people viewed the courts should be acting. There are people who are living in the community who may still have that mindset of, hey, once a prisoner, always a bad guy?
Sure, definitely. I think, you know, just around people with felony, you know, records in general, there's still a lot of, you know, what's known as, you know, civil disabilities that those people, in a sense, have to overcome. They could be, you know, bars to certain types of employment. They can't get licenses. It could be licenses for, you know, to sell real estate, for to become a barber, you know, for example. There's been issues in other states where individuals in prison are trained to become barbers, and then when they get out, they actually can't practice that profession. So there's
a terrible catch 22.
Absolutely.
Sure. And then there's other issues now around not being able to, you know, work with certain populations. Could be children, school-age children, could be the elderly. And, you know, based on, you know, just changes in, you know, United States in general, there's a lot of, you know, jobs in the, you know, healthcare field, home health care for the elderly that people might be barred from even engaging in.
And I think the issue of civil death is really important. And some states have tried to overcome that. Wisconsin has a provision that over a number of years, once you're on supervision in the community, if you keep your nose clean, you don't get involved in criminal activity, you can get those civil rights back. But they're significant and they vary across this country. There are significant proportions of African-American populations in the South, for example, that will never be able to vote. And they are totally disenfranchised and alienated. In Alabama, upwards of 50% of African-American adult-age males will never be able to vote, barring a change in the legislation. And there's been a lot of movement among reform groups to say this is the first step that we have to take. But it's a slow process. It's a legislative process. Again, Wisconsin is not as severe in that regard, but there is still civil death. And there are constantly discussions in the state of Wisconsin among some legislators to further restrict and to keep those restrictions, particularly regarding employment. And employment is very, very powerful in the criminological literature in terms of what we call desistance, stopping the criminal lifestyle. Well, everybody, you know, you don't need to be a PhD to figure out a job makes sense and some meaningful employment. Nobody expects a prisoner coming out of an institution to get a high-paying job. Nobody has that expectation. But they have an expectation that you can't have it both ways. You can't say you want to punish people totally and then you don't want to change any behavior, but you don't want to give any resources that will allow them to enhance within the community. There's a real interesting contradiction that's going on in American society about what we value when it comes to prisoners and to redemption and restoration.
So Tom, is the problem the law or the rules that are made by state agencies that govern what you can and can't do? Or is it more a matter of the attitude of us who are receiving folks who leave prison and come back into our communities?
Well, I think it's really both. I think if you look at how much this idea has changed around, you know, incarcerating people as the solution. So even if you look at, you know, recently around this idea that here in Wisconsin now the cost of the correctional system is more over $1 billion. It's more expensive than how much money or support's being given to the UW system as a whole. So you look 25 years ago, for every dollar spent on higher education, Wisconsin only spent 20 cents, you know, on corrections. So you see how that's totally flipped. So it basically was a strategy for a while. We'll build our way, you know, out of this. And now we've gotten to the point where now the strategies are changing, and now you're saying, well, now what can we do to assist these people in reintegrating back into society? But, you know, the mindset for many people, you know, students, you know, we have in our classes, 20 years old, they don't know anything else in the United States except we lock people up. You lock people up for as long as possible. But again, the reality is that 95%, you know, return home. Most of them, when you talk to them, they want the same things as everybody else. They want just to have a decent living, you know, have a decent, you know, home or apartment, and, you know, have as good a life as possible.
You hear a lot of stories about recidivism. People who get out of prison, get back on the street, come back home to their neighborhood, and in not too much time, back in trouble, back in prison. How real is that statistically? I mean, have you tracked, you know, here in Wisconsin, whether in fact that is the reality for most of those 95-94% who go to prison and are eventually released?
Sure. There's been a bunch of studies that the federal government has sponsored looking at, you know, many different states and tracking people for 3 years to see if they get either rearrested, reconvicted of another offense, or, you know, reincarcerated. And going back really almost 30 years now, what these studies consistently show is that probably 40 to 45% of the individuals released from prison are reincarcerated within 3 years. And that reincarceration can be based on a new crime, you know, convicted for a new crime or for violations of their supervision, so that they violated conditions of their supervision. So nationally, that hasn't changed much, you know, in this whole 30-year period. Most recently, some studies that included Wisconsin among, you know, many other states found that in Wisconsin, that figure in 1999 and 2004, tracking people for 3 years, was about 46%. So 46% of the individuals released from prisons here in Wisconsin were reincarcerated within 3 year period.
And what's interesting, Tom, to supplement that, probably one of the most exhaustive studies ever done was out in California, in which they looked at the entire parole population, which is an administrative decision to release somebody early before expiration of sentence and to allow them to be supervised in the community. That's a major release mechanism that we have. They studied and followed 234,000 parolees who were released from 2003 to 2004, and they published their results in 2008. And what they found was it's not only the high failure rates, but when they fail. And they tend to fail in the first 6 months. In their distribution, 90% of the people were failing in the first 6 months to 12 months. And so we know that, and we've known that for a number of years, actually. How best then do we develop policy? Well, it sounds like when people first get out, they need the strongest supports. They need the strongest resource base. They need the strongest involvement of both the correctional system as well as other institutions in society if they're going to succeed. If they last out to that 3 years, as Tom suggested, then there's a good probability statistically that they're not going to be a problem. And so there's a lot of issues there in terms of allocation of dollars again.
I take it from your comment that you are suggesting there isn't enough resources put in at the back end as there is on the front end of actually keeping people in prison. Once they get out, the money doesn't seem to be there to help them get over that hump in that first year.
I think that has been slowly recognized as a reality now, and it's been a differential response across the country. You know, states that were pro-incarceration for many years. Texas, for example, has changed their tune when it comes to this issue, largely around the finances. They just don't have the money any longer to subsidize, you know, 105 prisons, prison a county they basically used to have in Texas. They're changing the way they're doing things. New York is another big system that has changed its approach to this. Who hasn't changed is the federal system, which is now the largest system in terms of the number of prisoners. California was forced to change with a Supreme Court decision last year. They have to reduce by 40,000 prisoners by May of 13.
Well, because they had such huge overcrowding issues.
And the court, which was a conservative court, nobody ever expected the Supreme Court to say to a state government, yes, a federal judge can intervene and tell you what to do, executive, in this case the governor. They thought that would never happen. Well, it was a close decision. 5-4, Brown versus Plata is the decision. But it ultimately produced a massive change and a release of a lot of people and a change in policy and practice. And that's what's important. These are choices. We can make different choices. The question is, can we make good different choices? That's the real issue.
You're listening to UWM Today on WUWM. Good to have you with us this week. I'm Tom Lujack. Joining us in the studio are Tom LaBelle. Tom is Associate Professor of Criminal Justice at the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UWM. And his boss, I can say that, right? Stan Stojkovic, who's the dean of the school. And we're talking about the challenges that come when prisoners leave the bars behind and get back out onto the street, back into our community. How well do they adjust? How can we help them adjust to be more successful in staying out of prison in the future? Tom, as Stan was talking about the resources and the sense that there's not enough going in once the people walk back on the street, can you give us some examples of the type of support specifically that your research suggests could make a difference in those first 6 or 12 months when it seems it's so crucial to determine the ultimate fate of these prisoners as to whether they'll remain ex-prisoners or be back behind bars?
Sure. I guess, I mean, the federal government has been supporting more, funding to trying to develop different programs, strategies in this area. So the Second Chance Act began in 2007. And since then, the federal government's been funding approximately $60 to $100 million each year to particularly states and local governments, looking at this idea around how do we ensure that this transition that people are making is successful and promotes public safety. So a lot of the programming that's built into this has to do with, trying to, enhance the employability of these individuals, engage them in substance use treatment after they get out. So even if someone's been in prison, they might say, well, I've been clean for 3 years, but they've been in a controlled environment. Now they're going to be released, oftentimes returning to the same neighborhoods where drugs are and alcohol are much more readily available. They need those types of supports to help them deal with some of the substance use issues they've had. Other areas, again, adequate housing, trying to support, housing for people. Mentoring is a big issue today that's being supported, by the federal government, having both mentors within the community. They could be, from the religious community. They could be from the business community. Some are successful formerly incarcerated individuals themselves that can really help to promote success for people returning home. So there's a bunch of different strategies and programs occurring today that seem to be able to make an impact, help these people to succeed.
How much grassroots activity is happening here in Wisconsin, more specifically here in Milwaukee, to help get a lot of those ex-prisoners be successful in their new lives?
Well, my sense is that 50% of all prisoners in the state of Wisconsin come from one county. That's Milwaukee. And we have specific zip codes within the county of Milwaukee, specifically the city of Milwaukee, that contributes a disproportionate number of inmates to the prison system. So a lot of these people are going to be coming back to Milwaukee. Milwaukee has the Felmers Cheney Pre-Release Center. Tom serves on that board. I'm an associate member on that board. They're working very, very hard to try to facilitate reentry kinds of efforts. It's tough in a community that is in a bad way, largely, particularly in the neighborhoods where these young men, more often than women, come from, where there's massive unemployment, where there's issues of just disarray in the family, where there's issues of just crime, other crime, as well as availability of illegal drugs and the excessive alcohol. I mean, all these social institutions are really broken in many cases in these communities. So Felmer's Cheney can't solve those community problems, but they can help. And similarly minded or similarly situated institutions help in the adjustment, particularly the reintegration with employment and family issues. They can do that. They can also implement what we know from the science. The catchphrase in social science nowadays is evidence-based. Well, what do we have in terms of good evidence? We do have some good evidence, and Tom has been a major player nationally in the creation of that evidence. How do we go forward and learn from that and then make the application? But people need to know this is a protracted issue. This is not going to be solved overnight, and it really requires fundamentally some redirection on the part of the Department of Corrections, and that represents the governor as well as the legislature.
Is there any evidence that it would be better not to lock up so many people, or not to lock them up for so long, so that we don't have years of anger pouring out of these folks when they do hit the street and say, now what? You know, mm-hmm. I was put away for, 10 years, and, what do I have to work with? I'm starting from ground zero. Or is that a non-starter politically?
Definitely. There's been a big push nationally for alternatives to prison program. So if you look nationally, for the first time, the prison population it's stabilized, and some states have reduced their prison populations. And one component of that is these alternatives to prison program. So for example, a drug court program, the drug court program right here in Milwaukee County is one of their criteria for selection there. In a sense, it's people that might be prison bound, but they know they have serious substance use issues that need to be addressed. They get into, the drug court. They get a lot of, services from agencies here in the community. You also have the important component of, the judge's involvement, interacting with the individuals every week, every 2 weeks, certainly every month. And the thought is that they get the treatment they need, which they either don't get in prison, or it's so disconnected from their actual life in the community that it's less effective. You get them through the treatment. This can be 12 to 18 month process, and also getting help in other areas around maybe some help with finding employment, that it's a win-win in a sense. It's best for that individual that they finally get to deal with a lot of their issues when it works. They don't even enter the system, so you save a lot of money and resources that way. And then hopefully they can go on and live a crime-free, just successful life.
There's also a caveat here. When people talk about alternatives to incarceration, they need to understand that you only reduce prison populations if Joe Smith is in a drug treatment program and we don't send him to prison in lieu of this new program, then nobody else can take Joe Smith's place in the prison. And that's a sentencing issue, okay? The analogy I'll draw is one of my other colleagues, Rick Lovell, has drawn. You don't save any money by going to a car dealership. They tell you save money. You only save money if you don't buy the car, okay? It's the same thing. If we keep people out of Milwaukee, out of the prison system, because we have an alternative program, the only way you reduce prison populations is if that bed intended for Joe Smith is not used by somebody else. And the system has an enormous plasticity to it in which it adapts, and then other people wind up in the system. So it's a much more complicated process in terms of reducing crowding, if that's your interest in these alternatives as well.
A few weeks ago, I was doing some volunteer work with my church, visiting some homes not too far from here. And in one of our visits, we came across a young guy who just was released from prison. Well, I thought he was young. Looked at him. He was in fabulous shape, muscular, and learned later he was 51 years old. I said, holy cow. Wow, you have really, you've been taking care of yourself. He said, well, I've been in prison for 17 years. And he said, you know, there's nothing else to do but work out. And he said, I'm out now. I served my time. I really want to turn my life around. And our church was providing some services mm-hmm. to try to help him get the tools he needs to get going. And I walked out of meeting this young man, and I said to myself, my goodness, here's a guy who just wants to be straight. He wants to be clean. And yet I looked at the neighborhood that he's living in, and temptation everywhere. You know, it's got to be enormously, enormously difficult for someone who has all the best intentions to find that job, to make sure that they surround themselves with the right circle of friends. Is there anything we can do to help promote that?
I guess that's where that mentorship, issue is really coming to the fore, right now that, having that support system, it's one of the hardest things, it's around this idea of, desistance in a sense. What leads people to succeed is different from what's led people to be involved in crime in the first place. So if you look at an idea, say, around, antisocial companions, lead people to be, involved in drug use or crime. You take those away, now what's the person left with? You need to build that pro-social component side. So what are they involved? What types of pro-social networks are they involved in? It could be through mentors, again, through a church, through different activities the person's engaged in. And that's really the difficult, part of this. You're taking away their entire life, in a sense, and saying, okay, don't, hang out with Johnny anymore. But now you need to replace it with something that's more positive. That's where, again, the mentorship or trying to get individuals involved in some type of pro-social work. An interesting thing you find with quite a few released prisoners is they're interested in giving back. So you find organizations that are either formed entirely by formerly incarcerated individuals or they're part of organizations where they say, you know what, I don't want younger people to make the same mistakes I did. What can I do to help these individuals so that they don't, go down the road that I went down?
And that's exactly what happened in the encounter that I had with this young mm-hmm. man who just was released. He said, this is great stuff that you're doing. We're helping him get a bed and some stuff to cook with in the kitchen. And he said, can I volunteer? Can I help? And I was struck with this desire to be giving back when he didn't have anything to begin with himself. Mm-hmm. So it's that mm-hmm. modeling that perhaps can make a big difference.
Right. So you hear a lot, it's peer mentoring in a sense. So you see a lot of individuals interested in that. One component of that is worth pursuing is if they're working with individuals, they have their experience from being in the system, maybe of drug use in the past, of committing crime, so they can, the people know that they've walked in their shoes, the people that are just coming out of prison. The component that's lacking that needs to be supported more is help these people, get degrees, as substance use, counselors, get more social work skills. And you see, it's happening in some places in the country, but it would be great if you could link those two together for these individuals. So the experience component is a great asset to bring, but they still need some of the training that, professionals would receive that could really, enhance their ability to help these individuals.
Well, gentlemen, it's a fascinating topic. I mean, this is clearly going to be a challenge for society, not just for the individuals who are leaving prison, but, Stan, as you pointed out, the price tag being what it is, at what point does the register have to stop ringing mm-hmm. in order for us to say enough is enough, both in terms of dollars going out the door as well as taking care of the needs of the people who are there. Thanks so much for the conversation today.
Absolutely.
Great. Thanks for having us.
Tom LaBelle, Associate Professor of Criminal Justice, and Stan Stojkovich, the Dean, both at the School of Social Welfare, Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UW-Milwaukee, our guest on this edition of UWM Today. Well, that's all for this week. Take care, everybody. We'll see you next week at the same time. I'm Tom Lujack.
You've been listening to UWM Today, the weekly program where you meet the faculty, staff, and students at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee who help make a difference in the lives of people in southeastern Wisconsin through their teaching, research, and community service. To To learn more about UWM, go online to uwm.edu.